Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Faith Church Podcast. I'm your host, Jay Williams, and joining me today is Jeff Clossy.
Hey, Jay. How's it going, man?
It's going all right.
Good to be with you.
I know. I'm back.
Did we remember how to do this?
I'm struggling remembering how to do a lot of things for the last couple of weeks.
Well, it's good to have you back.
It was weird even trying to reply to emails and use it. I mean, there's so many things that it's like, man, I'm really out of the loop, out of sorts.
Yeah, well, we're glad you're back. I know that transition back is always a unique thing, especially when vacation ends up being a surgical procedure. That's very different.
You know, here's the thing about that. I didn't say this on Sunday, but people, and it's kind of people to express sympathy for the fact that it was on my vacation that, you know, I end up in the hospital having a surgery. But here's the upside of it. It was at the very end of my vacation. It actually just extended my vacation.
There you go.
We got to do, the kids and I did everything that we wanted to do. And then it was the very last night where all this happened. And so in a sense, I ended up like in a bed with somebody telling me, hey, you can't go home from your vacation yet.
You must stay out here in Colorado longer.
So just imagine that, like, you're sitting in an Airbnb somewhere and then somebody authoritatively says to you, you can't leave vacation yet. You can't go back to work yet. And you'd be like, oh.
I'll submit to that.
Yeah. Now, there were other complications with that, but yes. Overall, it was, and then, you know, Lauren flew out and helped us get back. And so it wasn't the worst thing in the world other than the anesthesia, which I didn't do well. You don't do well with anesthesia either.
I just need a lot of it. It takes a lot to knock me out, Jay. The Irish keep fighting till the very end.
I know. It's so funny to me that the Irish genetically.
Yep. Red hair, freckled, typically require more apparently. Yeah. So
why is that?
I don't know. It's just a gift.
That's quite a gift. Yeah. It's like a superpower.
Something like that.
You ever think about bad superpowers of like if you, the short end of the stick? I was just watching the Avengers recently.
Oh, wow.
And so you think about, oh, wow, those are the superpowers that are worth it. But if there were such a thing as superpowers, you'd think that some people have like, they can sew really fast or you can... I don't know.
Very hard to drug.
Very hard to drug. Yeah, very hard. Very hard. Very resistant to anesthesia. I once said that my superpower was being able to persevere through awkward situations. It'd be like, awkward man. And like, that's not much.
What kind of costume does that guy wear?
Something awkward. So yeah, I feel like that would be me. And so then I would just be an extra in one of those films. And they're like, who's that guy over there? Oh, that's awkward guy. He just kind of stands there. Oh, he doesn't do anything else? Well, you know, he's helpful in awkward situations.
How does he make you feel? Well, awkward. It's such a gift.
So anyway, well, speaking of awkward, let's do an awkward transition into the message on Sunday, which, talk about feeling out of practice. It's amazing. That's why.
You were facing the right way the whole time.
Thank you. It is interesting. Anytime that I have even a couple of weeks off from preaching, getting back into that is a little bit of a challenge. And it just allows me to sympathize even more when your main pastoral role is not regular preaching. And I know you and Christoph mm-hmm. have both expressed that. And I just know it's going to take you guys longer to prep a sermon than it does for me when I'm in a rhythm, because you're not in that rhythm. That's not your weekly rhythm. And it just feels a little bit like getting on a mountain bike every time I get on a mountain bike. Because it's a few times a year that I actually get out there and get on the trails. And so every time there's a little bit of a, oh yeah, I got to remember how to do this.
Yeah, that's a good way of saying it. And I mean, but then as you do it, you're like, oh yeah, I love this. And that's what I would say. My experience is like, yep, takes a little prep,
yeah,
but I love it and so thankful to get to do it. I enjoyed this sermon a lot. I think that the things that you hit on regarding, so just a reminder to those listening, we're in Hebrews chapter 11, all about faith and all these examples of faith throughout the history of God's people. And the way that you talked about faith on Sunday, I thought was so encouraging, and it was really complimentary to how Christoph introduced the series here, the like mini series on faith in the middle of Hebrews about the nature of what it is. Because I think that this is one of the most important things today for us as followers of Jesus to have clear in our head. Like, what is faith? Because there are so many misunderstandings and misapplications of what it is. And to misunderstand it is to really miss Jesus and to miss what he has for us. So I'm so thankful that we kind of slowed down here. It's a longer chapter, so we're just approaching it differently. But it's valuable for us to sit in it and to really think about, what is faith? What does this mean that we trust Jesus? And we talk that way, right, all the time. We go to faith church. You know, we're pretty unique that way within the emphasis, but I think we don't often have time to really think deeply about what is it? What are we talking about?
Yeah. Why do you think that is, though? That we have a question here that I think, and we could lead off with that because I think it's really at the core, at the crux of a chapter like this, which is we often don't talk about the kind of the nitty gritty details about faith in ways that we sometimes will about other theological issues. Faith, I think if you asked most people in the church, what is faith? You'll get probably some pretty surface level answers. And we'll even have phrases like blind faith, and like, we'll just kind of get this picture of, well, faith is just, you know, it's jumping off a cliff and you don't know what's there. And it's much deeper than that. Mm-hmm. And it's much more tangible than that. I think that's the point, is we think of it as very intangible and very like just intangible and hard to grasp. And so it's just like a feeling or a thought. But what Hebrews 11 is doing is making it very tangible and yes. saying, this is what faith is. And now here are examples of how these people, what they did, that was faith.
Yep.
And it was all action. It's none of it was, not a single one of the people in chapter 11 are defined by what they thought mm-hmm. or what they declared. So it's all like, oh, you want to know what faith looks like? Look at what they did. Look what they did. Look what they did. Look what they did. And that's not typically how we think of faith.
No, and I think often faith is equated essentially with wishing for something. So you have faith, and it's like an overlap with hope, you know, like I wish this happened. I wish it were true that. And I think that's sometimes culturally what ends up happening because we're at a place right now where knowledge and faith are often put on two opposite sides of each other as if they're opposed to each other. So if you know something, you don't have faith. If you have faith, you don't know something. They're kind of like two different things. And I think actually contrary to that, they are not opposed. The more you know about something, the more faith you have, you're able to have in it, which is exercised trust. So the kind of faith that Jesus calls us to is a faith that is based on the knowledge that he presents about reality in himself. It is not an irrational thing. It is not a mere wishing. It does involve things that we have not been able to see with our own eyes. And all of these people, like the examples of like Abraham from this Sunday, he didn't know, he couldn't see with his own eyes where he was going to go and how that was going to work out. He didn't have turn by turn directions to the promised land, right? But he had faith that was based on knowledge because he actually knew God. He knew him. And that was not irrational. It was knowing a person the way we know people. And I think that sometimes, you know, you get the contrast between science and religion too. That's based on this misunderstanding that science is knowledge, religion is faith, right? But that's actually not true. When you go to a mechanic, for example, you want to go to a knowledgeable mechanic about your car, and you want to go to someone who's knowledgeable about it enough that he's confident and he can take confident action, which is an act of faith, to fix it. That if I do this thing, this will happen because of the knowledge I have of it. And that's what we want. And I think that's a different sphere because we're talking about knowledge in a much more relational way. Like the way I know you, Jay, is different than the way I would know how much something weighs. because personal relational knowledge is a different kind of thing. But we do know each other. That's solid, and that's fact. And based on the knowledge we have of each other, we have faith that certain things happen as we relate with each other, and we take action accordingly. So even like that we showed up to this room to record this podcast actually was an act of faith based on knowledge.
Yeah.
And so I think that that for us as we follow Jesus is so important. It's why it's valuable to continue to grow in our biblical knowledge. It's not just biblical knowledge for biblical knowledge's sake. It's knowledge that results in faith, which is, like you said, ends up being an action and a trusting commitment to live according to his ways and to rely on him as we do life. It's inevitable you're going to have faith, right? That's inevitable. Everyone has faith as they make decisions throughout their days.
Yeah. And the question is like, do I have faith in myself and in what I know about the world? And that was part of the thing with Abraham. He knew, he had knowledge about his current standing, where he was, the wealth that he had, where the, what he knew about his homeland. And he would have had to been, if he would have stayed, it would have been exercising faith, but it would have been faith in a different kingdom and faith in himself. Exactly. And faith in his own circumstances, trusting in that. And I think that, so I think one of the big pieces that you're touching on here, and there's a couple that I think we could address and flesh out a little bit more. One of them is that faith is action. I mean, this is when James says faith without works is dead. Mm-hmm. You know, you show me your faith, I'll show you my faith by my works. That he's drawing that connection. He's saying that you're talking about a very superficial level of faith when you're just talking about the things you declare or the things you say you believe. And let me just read the question, because the question that came in was really great. And they just asked if we could flesh out a little bit how I made the point that just declaring, just saying you believe, just believing that he exists is not enough. And so they asked, could you flesh that out as it relates to Romans 10:9, which Romans 10:9 says, because if you confess with your heart that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart, or sorry, if you confess with your mouth that Jesus is Lord and believe in your heart that God raised him from the dead, you will be saved. For with the heart one believes and is justified, and with the mouth one confesses and is saved. So we have verses like that that have kind of led to this view. And I touched on the American faith that I mentioned. And what I meant by that was, it's been in the last, you know, 70, 80 years or so that this kind of idea of just professing like a prayer of salvation, like if I just declare that Jesus is Lord, declare that I believe, then by that confession, if I believe it, you know, like almost like a Wizard of Oz, like, if, you know, click your heels together three times, if I just believe hard enough, then I'll be saved. And there's truth in this, obviously, because it comes from scripture, but there's also like an oversimplification that then makes it not true. And in that is just what you were talking about, because it then removes, so then our idea is, oh, we're saved by faith, not by works. And so then we remove all action. And so we started to like cast out any action and saying, well, that's not of God. If you talk about works at all. But James says, that's how you know that you have faith. Like, mm-hmm. The idea is, yes, it is faith. Truly believing is what saves us. But the way you know if you truly believe is by your actions. Mm-hmm. If I can just say that I'm faithful to my wife, and I can even say I really want to be faithful to my wife, but we would all agree that faithfulness to my wife means something tangible. It's not just a desire or a wishful thinking or a belief that faithfulness is important. None of that is satisfying. We would say faithfulness means a particular action, like it means action. And the parallel that I would use in that, and we talked about this briefly right before the podcast, as I was thinking about this question was, I think we treat faith a lot the way that some churches will treat love. So maybe you've heard a church, you know, or somebody say, or even a church, it could just be anybody that has kind of a very generic faith that is not specific to the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus, but is just kind of this generic faith. And they'd say, well, you know, even Jesus says what matters most is that you love God and you love others. So as long as you're loving God and loving others, like, you're fine. Well, there's a sense in which that is very true. Jesus said, these are the greatest commandments and everything else hangs on these two. But I think we would also acknowledge that is a much deeper, there's a much deeper definition of what does it mean to love God with your whole heart, soul, and mind? What does it mean to love your neighbor as yourself? These mean actual things, and it's much deeper than just whatever definition I want to throw on it. So I think in the same way that you can oversimplify the great commandment by changing the definition of love, by oversimplifying the definition of love, or fitting the definition of love to whatever you feel good about, we do the same thing with faith. We take a passage like Romans 10:9 about confessing with your mouth and believing in your heart, and then we put our definitions on that of, oh, that means just saying these words, and that means like sincerely believing that Jesus, you know, did these things. And we oversimplify the definition and it changes the meaning of the whole passage. Does that make sense of how, like, well, I'm trying to draw that parallel there?
Well, it doesn't. I think it's helpful. Like, this is a really, I love this verse, this section of that Romans. We use this, like, when we baptize, we'll have baptisms in the park coming up again. And this is what I usually, when I'm baptizing someone, I ask this: do you believe in your heart? Do you confess with your mouth? Do you believe in your heart? I think this is a great, almost like a short little creed here that we can use. But if you think about the people who received this, the environment in which they received it in was hostile. It was illegal to follow Jesus. To do so was to potentially not only receive persecution, but lose your livelihood, become like oppressed people. So confessing with your mouth that Jesus is Lord in a culture that said Caesar is Lord, and to contradict that is to invite death on yourself, is very different than what we have now. So that's why it's important that we flesh it out. Like, what's behind that is a heart that believes to the point of action. This is kind of a funny example in another realm. I read this recently of a Christian thinker was writing about knowledge and faith, and he said, it's interesting how sometimes our faith is an exercise of what we know, and sometimes we have faith in things that we know aren't true. So like the example that he gave was buying lottery tickets. So buying lottery tickets actually does demonstrate a faith and a wishing that I will win the lottery. But most people doing that know they will not win the lottery. Their faith is actually contrary to the knowledge they have of what is real. And what Jesus is calling us to is something so beautiful, because it's just the opposite of that. It is, would you exercise faith, trust, confidence, those are all synonyms, to the point of action, because this is real, in how I have revealed reality to you to be. It is solid and it is not changeable. And so when you're declaring he's Lord, you're talking about the nature of reality and of all existence, that he is over all things. So it's not something that you can just agree with and just get on with your life as it was normal. If you just agree with it and get on with your life as if nothing has changed, you don't understand what you just confessed, because it's so fundamental to our life and all of reality.
I think you made a really good point there about who is Paul writing to in Romans. Mm-hmm. He's writing to Romans. Mm-hmm. And the biggest declaration that they would be making is Caesar is Lord.
Yes.
To say anything else was treason.
Yeah, this is treason right here.
And so when Paul's saying that, he's saying like you are declaring allegiance. You think about that culturally. I mean, there's lots of things that I could touch on here, but there are places in the world where they might say, hey, if you... to be saved, you need to believe. And the demonstration of that belief is you're going to gather with the church every week. There are places in the world where gathering with that church every week is a constant risk and a constant, like you are, it could be, It could be a physical risk. I mean, there are stories of churches that are in Tibet that are on like mountainsides, and people have to like go through a strenuous hike of, you know, hours and hours to get there. It could be that you could come home and your home could be burned to the ground because they know that on Sunday morning, these Christians are assembling here. And so you're leaving that. Now, you could imagine somebody saying that in that context, that that's what faith looks like, that you come to, that you attend church every week. Now imagine saying that in Dallas. It's not the same thing. There are places in the world, and especially in our country, where going to church not only is not costly, it is beneficial to your worldly kingdom. It's beneficial to your business reputation, to your contacts, to your, to like helping raise your kids and giving your kids like social interactions, like going to, you know, joining Little League. There, so you wouldn't say it like that. And so you have to think culturally, what is he speaking into? And so I would argue that Romans 10:9 is not what we've turned it into. It is actually a, so believe, and here's these, the, evidence that you're going to believe. You're going to confess with your mouth.
Mm-hmm.
You're not just going to say this quietly. You're not just going to believe this quietly and kind of going about your business. You're declaring this with your mouth, which is an act of treason. It is an act of declaration against the kingdom of Caesar and for the kingdom of God. And so if you really do believe, you will, that's worth it to you. And so it is, even in that passage that we would point to of saying what's been used for decades to say, like, see, it's, if you pray a prayer of salvation, you're good. Even that is actually contained in it, is a tangible action that at the time, in that context, would have been dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been costly.
Yeah, I was actually just thinking about Dietrich Bonhoeffer's phrase, cheap grace. And he was writing that in the 30s, right, I believe. That's been an issue in the church for a long time, much longer than where we're at right now. But I think the way it manifests right now is unique. It just is. And yeah, it doesn't really cost most of us anything to at the park confess that openly, although we should do that. It's a good thing to do, but it's very different than what the people Paul was writing to were experiencing. You're right. It can actually enrich us to do that.
Well, and think about, here's another one that I was thinking of. Imagine that the letter said, if you want to be saved, you have to believe in your heart and wear a cross necklace.
a fish bumper sticker or yeah, you know, whatever.
There are places in the world where if you wore a cross necklace, you would be endangering your life every time you went out. But that would not be the same here. Like, lots of people wear a cross necklace that it means nothing. You know, even having a tattoo, I'm amazed at how many times I'll strike up a conversation with somebody about their cross necklace or about a tattoo with a cross or something on it, and find that they don't actually believe in Jesus. It represents something completely different to them. The question is what Hebrews 11 is defining faith by. And I think the reason why they give so many different examples is because faith is costly. If you actually believe this, then you will act in this way. You'll know because you'll act in a particular way. And it can be different for different people. Like there are things that would be costly for you to, like, exercising faith, it's costly. And like for me, it wouldn't be. I've said that before about Sunday morning. There are people who come to church on Sunday morning for whom it is an exercise in great faith. And then there are others where it's not. Some people come to church and it's easy to come to church. It's either easy because you're a hyper extrovert and you just, it's like, and you love music and you love whatever. I'm not saying that you don't also believe. I'm not saying that, like, and I'm not saying that's a bad thing to say, like, oh, I love, you know, I like to see my friends or whatever. That's great. But it's different than the person who is battling depression or for whom coming into the church and seeing certain people is really painful. or whatever is going on, where they're having to, it's exercising great faith to show up. And for other people, it's not, it's easier. I've used the example before of like when people have said to me in the past, because I don't worry about money, they're like, oh, and I wish I had your faith when it came to money or God's provision. And I said, well, I often say, I don't know if like there's some faith in there, but I'm also kind of irresponsible when it comes to money. Like, so I don't worry, like you can not worry about money because you're exercising faith, and you can also not worry about money because you're irresponsible and you just don't think about it very much, and it's not a big deal to you. It's different for different people in that. But I think of all of that, I think what I would want to say is it's a great question. I think it's an important one to ask of, okay, well then how are we saved? And we are saved by faith. Mm-hmm. But it is by faith as the Bible defines faith, not faith as I define faith or as our culture defines faith. Just like we are called, the great commandment is to love God and love others, but as the Bible defines love, not as I just want to think about love or what the culture wants to think about love. We know that in other areas that we have to let God define our terms. And so it's not me who's saying like, well, you know, you got to prove your faith or whatever. It's none of that. It's just God gets to define what faith looks like. And he has in scripture multiple times over and over again. It's fascinating to me. If you see like the circular kind of all of Hebrews is saying, this is not about your works. Mm-hmm. It's about the work of Jesus and your faith in the work of Jesus, that he's the better sacrifice. He's the fulfillment of the law. So follow that train of logic. He's like, the whole argument is, this is not about obedience to the law or your sacrifices. Jesus has fulfilled all that. It is about your faith in him. And now in your faith in him, that looks like this action, your works. Mm-hmm. Yep. It's undoing, it's building, it's tearing down to the very foundation of their faith, of what they believed it meant to try to please God or live for God. It's tearing it all the way and then rebuilding it back up. You're still, you know, it's like if you tore down a house and then you rebuild it, you might use some of the same materials or whatever, but they're different. They're in a different purpose or they're in a different place. And so we're not made righteous by our works. We're saved and made righteous by our faith, which is demonstrated by our works. And it's the difference between when Jesus says, if you love me, you'll keep my commandments. If in your mind that is, well, if I keep the commandments, then I'll prove that I love him. That's not what he's talking about. He's saying, look, if you love me, you're going to do what I say. Like, that's the evidence that you love me. And that's just not, like, it's so weird to me. Here's what's weird to me. And I know I've taken longer than my normal turn. But here's what's weird to me. We understand this in everyday life, but for some reason with Jesus and with God, we like check it at the door, like by this, that there's no other area of our lives that we would settle for just a declaration of something and not attach it to works. So if I just told you, I like, you're my friend and I want to be good friends with you, and yet I continually you know, gossip about you or prove to be untrustworthy and all these things, you're going to say, well, you don't, whatever you're defining as wanting to be a good friend, you don't actually want to be my friend. Like, you're not actually my friend. Just saying that, mm-hmm. you know, and I've said this before, just calling a thing doesn't make it that thing.
Yeah.
I can say like, oh, this is love. We see this all the time in the world where you're like, oh, this is, you know, in Hollywood, you say, well, this is love. And we're like, that's not real love. Like, that's infatuation. That's lust. That's, you know, whatever it is, but that's not God's definition of love. And so, I mean, think about if you told your boss tomorrow, like, I want to be the best employee. Like, I believe in this company. I want to be the best employee. And then you don't show up to work or you do a really bad job. And there's no other area in our lives that we would say, just saying the thing and just wanting it to be true is enough. And it's because you, and in every one of those circumstances, you would say, I don't believe you. Like if you say, like, you want to be my friend, I don't believe you. Why don't I believe you? Because of your actions. Your actions tell me that you don't actually believe this thing that you're saying. And so, yes, it is genuine faith, genuine belief. But how do we know that that faith is genuine? It is, it'll show in our works. Plus, Jesus tells us a million times over in these parables. That's why he says that if you put your hand to the plow and look back, you're not fit for the kingdom. It's why the parable of the banquet, that those who had other excuses, and they're basically saying, oh yeah, no, I totally want to be there, but I got to take care of these other things first. And Jesus doesn't say, well, they'll get the leftovers, or, well, whenever they come in, that'll be fine. He says they won't eat at this banquet. They will not taste it. That's a strong warning to say, like, look, you're showing what you actually believe. Yes, it is just about your faith in me, but you're showing what you actually believe by how you act.
Yeah, it's really, the whole book of Hebrews is profound in the depths of what it gets at with how humans work, like what's going on in our hearts. Like we talked about the division of soul and spirit at one point, right? Like it kind of gets to the whole bottom of what's going on inside of us. And this chapter, living by faith, I think it like puts a bow on all of that and gives us illustrations that it's not possible for any one of us as human beings to live without faith, because faith, I just the first verse again of Hebrews 11, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Every single one of us got up this morning not knowing what the outcome of our day would be because we cannot see it yet. I can't see 6 p.m. tonight. I have no idea. So in order to get there, I need to trust. I need to live and trust what I have knowledge of. And this is a call to make each one of those decisions throughout our day in confidence of how Jesus has revealed God to be and what the scriptures say about him and how the Spirit is working within us. And it gets at like that every single day that every human being lives will be based on trust in some way, because we don't have control of outcomes and we cannot see a minute from now what's going to be happening. So we have to live in trust. And God built us and made the whole world so that every decision and every act would be made in trust to him. And that's where we flourish. And I love that in the sermon you got there too, that one of the things we need to trust him most with, and one of the things that I think motivates our actions more than anything else, is our desires. Do we believe that he knows how to fulfill the deepest desires of our heart in the best possible way? Do we believe God knows how to do that and that it's only found in him? Or do we believe we know better and we need to take this, you know, path that we're on in order to fulfill those things? And I'm really excited that the church, like the big church, not just our church, is at the place right now where we're able to talk about desires in a new way. I think it is really unique, at least in my lifetime, where it feels like we're recognizing, yes, sin is when you err and when you don't obey the law, but there's reasons for that. And some of the reasons that we end up sinning are because of actually very good desires that we are seeking to fulfill in very broken ways. And I think this whole chapter gets at, how do you start changing that? How do you start taking steps away from that if you don't want that anymore? If you want your desires that God gave you, like a desire for intimacy, just giving that example, relational intimacy and connection with people. There's all kinds of ways culturally that people pursue that good desire in ways that end up bringing harm upon themselves and harm upon other people. There are, but God has given us ways of fulfilling that, that both honor him because it reflects who he is, his image, which is always love, true love, like you were describing earlier. He gives us ways that those desires are meant to be fulfilled that actually bring joy to us like we couldn't have imagined. And I just love that that's where we are right now, because we can talk about things being right and wrong all day, but unless we get at why and how do we change it, it's not helpful. Because we end up, I think, just doing what we're describing here as kind of a cheap faith or a cheap grace where we just acknowledge, I agree with that. I agree that's wrong. And as if that's the end of the story. or I agree this behavior is right, but we aren't able to live it out and enjoy it the way God intended us to. So I love, the example of Abraham to me is such an apt one at getting at that, what he was called to, that he could not have foreseen how it would end or even how it would unfold. It required trust in a person that is beautiful. And it is neat too that these characters, so like Abraham as the example, the thing we are called to emulate in him and to imitate is that trust. Because we don't live the life he lived. We're not called to the thing that he was called to. Or we have a different call, each one of us, and we can imitate his trust. And I mean, to me, that's what we do. That's what all of this is about, is growing in that together and actually doing that with Jesus.
Right. And you mentioned intimacy. And so then that kind of gets back to the idea of these rewards, that's the other part of that verse. Without faith, it's impossible to please God, that those who draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. And that's the kindness of God. He could just demand our allegiance because he's God, but he also rewards us. Like, he promises to fulfill our desires, and we have to trust that what he's fulfilling is better. Like, how he's fulfilling that is better. There's so many things that popped in my head. I thought of illustration of, if your boss called you into work and said, "Hey, I want you to work on Saturday. You know, you're normally off on Saturday. I want you to work on Saturday, but I'm going to pay you double time." Whether you go in or not is based on whether you believe him. If you don't believe him or her that they're going to actually pay you, and then imagine when your paycheck comes around and it doesn't show that you got paid double time. And what if their response was, I really wanted to pay you double time. Like, you're so valuable. You know, I promise we'll do that again. And I'll get it on there. And then if they never do, you would say, okay, well then you would stop. Your faith would be damaged in that. The next time they ask you to come in, you know, and during off hours, you're not really going to believe them anymore. But God calls us into these things, and he does reward us. He does, like, there are those rewards. And I tried to point that out, of they're both immediate and eternal, and that the immediate ones are better than the best that the worldly could offer. And you brought up intimacy, and I think that's a really important one. I've walked with people before who desire intimacy and they want to get married. And for whatever reason, it's not happening. Well, faith in that looks like bringing that before the Lord and trusting that, okay, God is going to fulfill my desire for intimacy. Now, what we tend to do and what we've done kind of in our legalistic American culture is, well, if you just go about dating in the right way or go about all this stuff in the right way, then he will bring you the perfect spouse. That's a lie. That's not what God promises. What he's promising is to reward you for your faith by fulfilling your desire for intimacy, which is first going to happen in him, and then it also can happen in other ways. But faith is saying, I don't know what this is going to look like, but I'm not going to pursue this relationship that I know is not of God. I'm going to pursue Christ. And I can... You know, there are people who have desired to get married, but God has fulfilled their desire for intimacy in other ways, through rich friendships, through restoring other extended family relationships, like with parents, or, you know, there's lots of things. And if you don't believe, like, what we often do with faith is we say, okay, God rewards me, and so he's going to reward me by building my own kingdom, like my own, like what I actually wanted. So if you imagine the crossroads is, okay, I can trust in me. I know how this will work here. So take intimacy, for example. I know that if I put myself out there and I start dating, and if I do X, Y, and Z, then I'll end up having, I can have a relationship, and I know how to do that. that's what's seen, that's what's known. And even though I know it's kind of broken, it's like, it's controllable in my mind, and I can do that. And even though we know it's not controllable and that backfires, and anybody who's tried to do that knows it backfires in all kinds of ways. And then you just keep going back at it versus saying, no, I'm going to trust God and I'm going to pursue Christ and trust that he knows how to fulfill my desire for intimacy better than I do. Okay. So if that's the crossroads, what we often then say is, okay, I'm going to trust God that he's going to fulfill what I want, meaning a marriage. So I'm going to try to do it his way. But that's not actually faith. That's just using kind of God as this genie of trying to like bless my kingdom, which is at war against his kingdom. And what faith looks like is saying, okay, I'm going to hold loosely. It doesn't mean squashing that desire for intimacy. And it doesn't mean to stop asking God, if you like in that scenario, if you want to be married, it doesn't mean stop asking God for the gift of marriage. What it means is holding it all loosely and just saying, but what I'm going to do is seek first the kingdom of God, and he's going to add everything else to me, everything that I need to fulfill this desire for intimacy, and to trust that the intimacy he has for you, whether that's in a marriage or in friendships, sometimes friendships with people that you wouldn't have first picked out as friends, that it's better, that you will actually be more fulfilled in intimacy in God's plan in that, even without, for example, the marriage that you wanted, than you would even with the best marriage that the world has to offer. And I was going to ask you this, like, how do we help people do that practically? Because I had a couple of emails in response, I think, partly to the sermon, but I think just in life, of another example is healing. Like, how do you pursue healing, asking God to heal you? But what does it look like to hold that loosely and believe that the healing that God has for me, that desire to be whole, that desire to feel like myself. I mean, what's underneath that desire for healing? There's different things. It might be a desire to feel like myself. Mm-hmm. If you're battling like a chronic illness, it could be a desire to live, like a desire for life. If you're battling a life-threatening illness, it could be a desire to experience joy. If you're dealing with like depression, there's a lot of different desires, but whatever that is, to say, okay, this desire that I want, it's not about squashing that desire. It's about laying that out to God and saying something like, okay, what I really want, God, is to feel like myself or to have life. But I'm going to hold this loosely. The way I think I want that is this, like, I want to be healed of this. And so that's my desire. But my desire ultimately is, like, I want to experience life, and I don't feel like I can experience life right now. And then so I turn that over to God and say, but I trust you to fulfill that desire, because you created in me this desire for life and for purpose and to have abundant life. Like, you promise abundant life for those who trust. That's a reward. And so I'm going to trust you of what that looks like and whatever you have for me here, to believe it's better even than if I whatever the best that the world has to offer. And I believe that someday I'm going to have the full experience. So that's like theologically that construct, and even with a little bit of practicality. But what does that look like when you're saying, for the people that are dealing with that, whether it is they're dealing with loneliness or illness or financial struggles, hardships, or relational hardships, and they're saying, I want to believe and I want to pursue the greater thing, but I don't know how to do that when I'm so struggling with this. Like, I can't, if you ask me what I want, I mean, I've mentioned before that, I forget who was the quote was from, especially when it comes to illness, where they said, if you ask a healthy person what they want, they'll have 100 different, if you ask 100 healthy people what they want, you'll get 100 different answers. If you ask 100 sick people what they want, you'll get one. And I think the same thing is true when, if you ask 100 people who are in relatively healthy marriages, What do they want? You'll get 100 different answers. If you ask 100 people who are in broken marriages, what do they want? You'll get one. If you ask 100 people whose kids are doing well, what they want, they'll get 100 different answers. If you ask 100 people whose kids are suffering, what do they want? You'll get one answer. So I'm thinking specifically for the people that are in the life stages or in the situations right now where they have one answer. When you ask them what do you want, there's just one answer. And it's the same thing they've been asking God for years maybe. What does it look like practically in that moment to have faith?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. You know, I would say a couple things come to my mind right away. I mean, one is, so if you're in the situation where you know, like you've identified, this is my desire and it's a good desire. And it's, I've been asking for that and I'm not getting that from God. I think the way, at least we see in the Bible, God's people respond to that situation is through lament. And so, Psalm 13 is like it's just a short psalm and it's a perfect example of what a lament is. But basically it involves coming to God with the honest feeling and the honest desires and even the disappointment that that hasn't happened and really interacting with him over that. So it's not just playing the video in your mind of what you want and then all that feeling that you have about that what you want. It's actually communicating with God all of those things. And part of what lament involves is then, and Jay, you were doing this as you were setting up the question, it involves seeking, like, what is true about God or what has God done in Christ? All these things that we see in Jesus and that God's revealed in the scriptures, what does he have for me? What has he provided for this right now? Like, how can I find comfort in the middle of misery? And I believe we can actually learn to do that. But it does involve some discipline. I think that, so lament is actually something that requires action. It requires time and energy to do it. But I do think for a lot of people, that's what the most important thing is, because we see Jesus doing that even when he gets close to the cross, when he says, you know, Father, let this cup pass from me. And then he ends by saying, but not my will, but your will be done. I believe that's like a short lament actually. And him, because he knew who God was, he knew that what he was entering into with him was actually going to be good. But he was honest about the fact that I really don't want that, if possible, like if there's any other way. And I think that's one thing. I would also say, watch your heart for, there's a difference between asking in faith and asking as a demand. And the request to God for something becomes a demand when we only have one possibility for how that desire could be met, you know? So like the example of intimacy, it has to be this relationship right in front of me, not even like the idea of something more like a marriage, but this person, that's a demand. And I would say that when we start doing that with God, we do start to, when we demand he fulfill our desires in a specific way, we are kind of putting ourselves above him and imagining that we know best what is good for us. And that's just not true. We don't. And I think most people doing that, if they're following Jesus, they know that already. They just have to be alerted to that fact. Like, we just don't know better than God does what is good for us.
Which, by the way, just interjecting in there, we are by definition then missing out on the better thing.
Yeah,
exactly. Like a child who asks for a cookie, not knowing that there is, you know, a whole like cake and ice cream buffet right behind it or whatever, and like insists on getting that thing. Yeah. We are just by missing out on something better. And that's part of that faith. Sorry. Continue.
No, those are just a couple things that come to mind. And I would just encourage the person in that spot to not go at that alone. Any of those things, you can lament with other people and you can pray and talk about desires with other people. And so I would encourage, it takes some courage and trust in God to actually talk with other people about that in healthy ways. But I would encourage you to do that. If that's what you're hearing this and you're feeling like, yeah, I have, that's me. Talk to someone who you come to church with or you sit near, or, you know, Jay and I always say this on this podcast, but reach out to us. We would love to, either help you connect with someone or sit with you and talk through what it is you're facing, because that's part of the human struggle, unfortunately, is that we are people that are in need of comfort. We are in people who are in need of refuge, and the temptation is always going to be finding it in ways that are not of God and trying shortcuts to get comfort or to find refuge in things that aren't actually safe, and they won't be. The beautiful thing to me about like this chapter and even this Hebrews, the book of Hebrews, and the new covenant promise of a changed heart and a new way of living with God in us is that we can actually not just survive those really difficult times, but actually grow in significant ways that bring joy that we couldn't have imagined through the difficult times. It doesn't mean that times aren't difficult. It doesn't mean that things happen that are okay because of that. There's a lot of bad things that happen. They're not okay. But we can, as we follow Jesus, experience him as shepherd as we walk through those things. So that would be just a couple general ideas, Jay.
I love that. I think that's really helpful. I think that just as I was kind of thinking about that, of how you do that with one another, I think lament is not the same thing as complaining. And so there's a faithful way to lament. And I think what you said about disappointment, I think sometimes we think that expressing disappointment is somehow like a faithless thing. It's not. You can express, but I like what you said. I think what we need help on sometimes is, you know, maybe it looks like this. Maybe it looks like sharing with somebody, hey, I'm really struggling with this right now. And I find myself being really fixated on one solution. Mm-hmm. I like how you said that the difference between the demand and a request of, that like a demand is when it gets very specific. And so we can confess that to one another of like, hey, I'm struggling right now with my health, and I'm getting really fixated on like this solution. And I want to hold that loosely because I want to believe that what God has for me is even better. You know, we talked about joy and peace. Paul is such an example. Philippians 4 is such a great chapter to read when to see the effects of sanctification, to see what it looks like in a life that is likely nearing its end, but that has been formed and shaped by believing God and trusting in him that what he has is better. Because there in Philippians 4, Paul just says, look, I can handle any of these circumstances because in Christ, I have everything that I need. My joy no longer goes up and down with, you know, whether I have a lot or I have a little, or if I'm healthy or I'm not. In all of these circumstances, whether he's being loved or being persecuted, whether he's in prison, whether he's free, like it's because this is a person who has learned over and over and over again that God does reward those who seek him and that what he has is better. And, you know, I've experienced that in my life, and yet even I still feel like I have to relearn it every time. I'm such a child when it comes to this stuff where I experience that and I'm like, oh man, that was better. And then the next time it's like, well, but is it really better? But that's what a life of faith eventually kind of grows. That's why God lets us practice, which by the way, is why we do this in the small things every day, why that matters, because that is the practice that then gives us hope and confidence. It's common for you and me both to interact with people who have given, like, it's so easy to give zero thought to God when things are smooth. And then as soon as a storm comes up, then all of a sudden you're trying to practice a faith and exhibit a faith that you've not been practicing. And, you know, it would be like, you know, you and your coaching soccer of like every practice, you just sit there and eat orange slices. And then all of a sudden you go out into a game and they're like, oh gosh, people are like trying to take the ball from us and everything. And like, what do we do? And you're like, oh yeah, sorry, we haven't practiced any of this.
But we love orange slices.
And so that would be part of my encouragement is if you are right now in relatively calm seas, don't take that for granted. Don't waste that opportunity. Be in the Word. Be in prayer. Look for ways to exercise faith to believe God, because there's going to come, stormy seas are going to come. And to bring that all like to a head as you pursue Christ in this, realizing that over time you realize that being with God in the stormy seas is a way more peaceful experience than being without God in the calmest of seas. And if you don't believe me, you can pick out anybody's life. Talk to anybody you know that you think has a very calm life, and they're going to have stresses. And if you ask them, like, what's stressing you out today? It may feel really small to you. Like, if you're dying of cancer and you ask somebody what's stressing them out today, they're like, I got like 8 emails to respond to. And you'd be thinking, like, I would trade if that was my biggest stress today. But the human condition is that we feel stress and we feel these things because we're out of control, because we aren't in control. What we're actually exhibiting is the reality that we know at our core that I don't know what 6 p.m. holds. And so I can't master any of this. And it's also communicating that even in the calmest of seas, you still aren't going to have peace without God. It doesn't last. It's very temporary. It's very fleeting. And that's what's really hard, by the way. When I've struggled with health issues, and even now as I struggle with them, it's hard not to believe that if this got solved, then everything would be fine. And yet anybody who has ever had any health issue that then goes away knows that did not, like, another storm is there, another illness, another hard trial. You've dealt with that. I've dealt with that. Like, there is a point, and I get it, what it feels like, where you're just saying, there's this one thing. If this one thing was fixed, then I'd be fine. But it's actually not true. The better thing is exhibiting that faith and building that relationship with God and being fulfilled in Him, because then whatever comes, you'll be able, your peace is not shaken, your joy is not shaken. And that's what He really wants for us. And all of that is in preparation for a day where it will all be completely fulfilled. Mm-hmm. But we'll be so well-versed in experiencing joy in Christ that will just magnify our joy for all eternity. And God won't settle for something less than that. He loves us too much to give us some kind of junior varsity experience of Him. And I'm thankful for that. And that's why we need one another, because how do you even remember all of those things? How do you hold on to any of those things? We need to be able to confess those things to each other and to be able to receive the gospel from one another and to be pointed back to Jesus in compassion. And we need people to lament with us. We need people to rejoice with us. We need people to remind us of His goodness. And so please do reach out. Don't do this alone. One of the marks of even people that we've known, I mean, you and I have this unique perspective that we know way more stories than anybody else knows in our church.
Yep.
And it's always amazing to me how often people think they are alone, and how often you and I would both be thinking, I know 5 people who are walking a very similar road to you right now. And sometimes we can't share that because we're trying to protect all that, but sometimes we try to in unique ways or try to get people connected. But I would just say, like, you don't need to walk it alone, because you're not alone.
No. And I would just give a real practical, real quick here. I know we need to land this plane. But if you're thinking that, like, yeah, I want that connection, one of the simplest ways to do that, I think, in our environment on a Sunday morning, as you say hi to someone that you've said hi to a lot of times, is to just say, hey, can I ask you to pray for something for me? And just, you don't have to tell your whole story. You don't have to reveal everything about yourself, but just say what your need is. And then say, is there any way I could pray for you? Just start there. And I know it takes faith to do that, because you're basically expressing a need, and that's some vulnerability, but that can be a way to start that conversation with people around you and alert them, to your need. Pray for me?
And just so you know, so we're clear, that need could be a specific tangible need, mm-hmm. or it could be the underlying desire. So maybe you're in a situation where you don't know that person well enough that you're like, I want to share all the details of mm-hmm. what's going on, But you could say, hey, could you pray for my encouragement? Because I'm just feeling really discouraged today. Yes. That's a need. And the person will pray for you in that. You can also offer specifics, but I'm just saying, like, there's different levels to do that. And it actually is a good practice in the exercise of what is the deeper need. Like, that's a really important self-diagnostic thing to say, okay, what is it I actually want here? What is it I'm hoping this thing will fulfill? Like, if I want this relationship, what am I hoping that'll fulfill? If I want this healing, if I want this thing, if I want this vacation, if I want this job, like anything that you want, like asking the question of why, and knowing that may very well be a good gift that God is going to give you to fulfill it, and rejoice in that. And that's amazing. That's awesome. But I would say that knowing what you're hoping for in that thing is important, whether you get it or not. It'll help you rejoice better if you do receive that, and it'll help you endure better if that's not, like, because you're saying, okay, but what I really want is rest, and then trusting God for how he's going to fulfill that rest and not in my own. That was another one that even in the sermon, I had a whole thing on rest, because we are kings and queens of feeling overwhelmed and busy and tired. And we insist, it's a cultural pandemic. We insist on pursuing our own known ways of rest that actually don't bring rest, whether it's youth sports or hobbies or social media or video games or, you know, Netflix, whatever it is. Like, we exhaust ourselves in our pursuit of rest. It's borderline comical, even in my own life, of how many times I'm like, I want to construct for myself rest. But that means stepping out in faith is, okay, God, I know what I really want is rest. I don't really want this hobby. I don't really want this. Like, that's not the thing. What I want is what I think that gives me is rest. And then pursuing that in Christ. And I know you and I both have examples of that, where sometimes I don't get the thing that I thought I needed for rest, and sometimes I do. But either way, if my rest is fulfilled in Christ, then all of a sudden that bike ride is 10 times more restful. Mm-hmm. In Christ, that fishing trip is way more restful than when it's in a pursuit of some worldly thing, you know? So anyway, that's another thing. We do have to land the plane. We hope that this has been helpful. Please reach out. You're not alone. You know the drill. We appreciate you taking the time to listen to us ramble on about these things, but we are in it together, and we love you, church. And until next time, grace and peace.